I'm Susan Yaffe with VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Coming up, U.S. Muslims fear being blamed for the Boston bombing. Rotting corpses are recovered from the streets of Aleppo, Syria.
The bodies had been lying around in the streets and in deserted buildings for days, weeks, and some actually for months.
Anti-government protests heat up ahead of a Bahrain auto race. And Egyptians look to the military as a blockade to chaos. It's all ahead. The FBI says the two bombs that exploded Monday at the Boston Marathon were carried in a dark-colored bag and possibly consisted of pressure cookers packed with nails and ball bearings. Two blasts, seconds apart, killed three people at the finish line of the Boston Marathon, including an 8-year-old boy. 176 people were injured. A number of them lost limbs. Authorities do not have any suspects and are asking the public to send in any photos or videos taken along the marathon route to help find who was responsible. Police and firefighter unions in Boston have offered a $50,000 reward for information leading to an arrest. But as the investigation continues, VOA's Carolyn Pursuti in Boston says the city is rebounding.
It seems as if Bostonians are getting back to normal. The commuters are having an easier time of maneuvering through the streets. There aren't that many streets closed as of right now. It started out that there were 15 blocks in the middle of downtown closed because that was the crime scene. But slowly and surely, each block is being reopened. There is a main stretch of Copley Square that is still closed, and one of the subways is still closed. But it looks as if Bostonians are walking to work, biking to work, driving to work. They're having an easier time of it today.
We asked what Bostonians are saying about the terrorist attack.
I think the first day, people were severely in shock. They were in disbelief. This couldn't have happened to us. This couldn't have happened in our city. A lot of people were walking around in how they described to me as autopilot, just walking, not really knowing where they were going. They would walk their normal route to school or to get a donut or a cup of coffee, and they would get stopped at the end of the street because of the crime scene and the barricades there. So then they would just, in a daze, turn around and try to find their way around the city that they knew so well. Now reality has set in, and they are angry. They're angry about the fact that their security was invaded. They don't feel like they can trust life as much as they did. They're not as comfortable with life. They're more on guard. But they are adamant about carrying on the tradition of the Boston Marathon, and they've actually scheduled it again for next year. They already have a date in mind. It will be April 21st in 2014, and many of the runners that I spoke with said they will be back. They will not let terrorists get the best of them. They say that they will be back in full force, and they will run this marathon in honor of those who died and in honor of those who were injured.
A reporter says the nation is responding to the Boston Marathon bombings.
It seems as if all of America is rallying around Boston. There were many prayer vigils held last night and even more today, and then tomorrow President Obama comes to Boston for the official prayer vigil here in town, the Interfaith Service. There are a lot of other things going on around the country. The IRS has extended tax day for those that live in the Boston area. All flags will be flown at half staff through Saturday around the country. There are various buildings, too, in downtown Boston that are lit up with red, white, and blue bulbs at night. In honor of the marathon, also, there's one bridge that is lit up in blue and yellow bulbs. Those are the colors of the Boston Marathon. We saw a lot of blue and yellow on the streets for the last 2 days during the day as runners would wear their souvenir marathon jackets as they walked around the city.
VOA's Carolyn Pursuti in Boston. A doctor at Massachusetts General Hospital says those victims listed as critical are improving. He calls the wounded amazing people, and that he is touched to hear some victims who lost a leg say they are just glad to be alive. Muslims in the United States are expressing grief and horror at the Boston bombings, much like other Americans. But some also are worried that they will be singled out for blame by others angry over the attack. VOA's Jerome Sokolowski has their story.
Very soon after the bombs went off at the finish line in Boston, a Twitter user who's reportedly from Libya wrote a comment that was retweeted by Muslims in the United States. It said, "Please don't be a Muslim." The Muslim Public Affairs Council was one of the retweeters. Haris Tarin heads the advocacy group's Washington office.
It kind of shares the sentiment of what American Muslims are thinking. Anytime there's a terrorist attack of this nature, American Muslims are attacked twice.
He says they feel attacked as Americans and singled out as Muslims because suspicions often quickly fall on them. President Barack Obama is cautioning against jumping to conclusions before all the facts are known. Tarin says that for the most part, U.S. authorities and political leaders are doing just that.
I think so far, law enforcement agencies and a lot of our public officials have been very responsible in their conversation and in their public statements on the issue.
While the September 11, 2001 attacks were carried out by Muslims in the name of Islam, there have also been terrorist attacks by domestic extremists that have nothing to do with Islam, says Ibrahim Cooper of the Council on American-Islamic Relations.
All we have to do is recall the 1995 attack on the Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City, where so many people were killed, and for the first few days, Muslims and Arabs were targeted.
In that case, two Americans motivated by anti-government sentiment were eventually convicted, and one of them was executed. Still, in the wake of the Boston attack, some anti-Muslim comments have appeared on social media sites. At the same time, the leader of an extremist Salafi group in Jordan says he was happy to see the horror in Boston. Ibrahim Hooper.
You've got billions of people on Earth with access to the Internet, and any one individual can offer some extremist view, but that doesn't represent the vast majority of Muslims worldwide.
U.S. Muslim leaders say the purpose of attacks like the one in Boston is often to divide Americans. They say the nation should respond with a show of unity, no matter who did it. Jerome Sokolowski, VOA News, Washington.
Fighting briefly halted in parts of the Syrian city of Aleppo Tuesday to give Red Crescent officials a chance to retrieve bodies rotting in the streets. Most of the victims, including some children, apparently were killed by snipers. But no one had been able to collect the bodies because of nonstop fighting and gunfire from Syrian troops and rebels. Some of the bodies had been lying there for months. We spoke about the retrieval with Rima Kamal with the International Committee of the Red Cross in Damascus.
A total of 34 bodies were evacuated from the three different spots of Aleppo City yesterday, after a truce was agreed upon by both sides to enable for this evacuation of the bodies. The bodies had been lying around in the streets and in deserted buildings for days, weeks, and some actually for months. The bodies were decomposed to the degree of that makes, you know, identification of the bodies very, very difficult. And sadly, this is something we're seeing increasingly in Syria over the past couple of months.
What will be done with the bodies?
The bodies will, of course, be handed to the morgue as a starter where maybe the identification process would start. Unfortunately, also the morgues in many parts of Syria are overflowing with dead bodies. And a lot of the bodies have actually also reached the stage that makes the identification process very, very difficult. Just last month, for instance, there were reports about 6,000 people killed in total and close to 1,400 bodies were unidentifiable.
This is a humanitarian issue, but it's also a health issue as well.
Of course, it is a major health concern as bodies remain in the streets for long periods of time and are not evacuated and so forth. And of course, the main solution would be to enable humanitarian workers and healthcare personnel to reach besieged areas and areas under heavy fighting to enable the evacuation of the dead bodies. Unfortunately, there has been incidents where healthcare personnel have been shot at deliberately or indeliberately, it is not clear, during the process of evacuation of dead bodies. And of course, this makes the evacuation of dead bodies extremely difficult as it puts the lives of people evacuating them under danger.
What sort of response have you gotten from the government as far as ceasefires?
We often try to negotiate ceasefires whenever we want to reach besieged areas, whenever there's talks about evacuation of wounded and dead bodies and so forth. And we've actually managed repeatedly over the last month, for instance, to negotiate a number of humanitarian pauses to cross front lines and to reach people in need. And of course, this remains a drop in the sea of the total number, let's say, of humanitarian pauses that are needed in Syria right now. And of course, the ultimate would be an immediate cessation to the fighting.
Rima Kamal, spokesperson for the International Committee of the Red Cross in Damascus. Earlier, as we reported, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad declared a general amnesty for crimes committed before Tuesday. It brought this reaction from U.S. State Department spokesman Patrick Ventrell.
Opposition activists remain skeptical of this amnesty, not least because tens of thousands of political prisoners remain in Syrian jails. So independent monitoring groups have not been in to see them, and so there's some general skepticism, particularly from human rights groups, about some of these claims.
Now, you agree with the principle that there seems to be no military solution for what's going on in Syria. So should that be perceived as a gesture to sort of initiate talks with the opposition?
Again, I don't think we're going to be getting into their head to try to interpret for them what they're trying to signal here, but this is something that the regime has said they do in the past. But again, there's tens of thousands of political prisoners that remain in Syrian jails.
U.S. State Department spokesman Patrick Ventrell during a Tuesday news briefing in Washington. Anti-government protesters in Bahrain are stepping up their demonstrations as Formula One drivers and their teams head to Bahrain for Sunday's Grand Prix auto race. A group of youth activists claimed responsibility for a car bomb in Manama Friday, in which no one was injured. As Henry Ridgewell reports from London, some British lawmakers are calling for the head of F1 to cancel the race.
Clashes between anti-government protesters and security forces on the island of Sitra, just south of Manama, Saturday, lasted for more than 8 hours, the latest in an upsurge of violence ahead of Sunday's F1 race. Activists who want more political rights for Bahrain's Shiite majority have announced a week of what they called volcanic flames aimed at disrupting the event. The auto race, widely followed around the world, is the premier event on the country's sporting calendar. Protesters claim it gives the government international legitimacy at a time when they say human rights are being brutally repressed. Dr. Nada Daif is a Shia activist who was arrested for treating injured protesters 2 years ago.
We are in unprepared situation of the martial law. The checkpoints are everywhere in Bahrain. There is severe traffic jam. Wherever you want to go, you will be checked, you will be stopped. The Shia villages in Bahrain is surrounded. There's daily attack, whether there's a protest or not.
Protests mainly by majority Shias against the Sunni-controlled government erupted in February 2011 at the height of the Arab Spring. The protests and crackdown by authorities go on and have intensified ahead of the F1 auto race. Bahrain's chief of public security is Tariq Al-Hassan. He says there will definitely be those who are not happy with the event or who may have their own agenda or view. But no information or talk bothers us, he says. We take our precautions and we are prepared. Bahrain's cabinet wants to impose jail terms of up to 5 years for defaming the king or the national flag, actions commonly alleged against opposition protesters. In Britain, a group of lawmakers has written to F1 authorities calling for the race to be cancelled. Andy Slaughter is the group's chairman.
The Bahraini dictatorship uses Formula One to pretend things are normal. You can come there and you can watch a big sporting occasion and people can live normal lives. The reality is that's not true at all for the majority of people in Bahrain all the year round, but particularly during the Grand Prix, when the country's in lockdown, where you've got armoured cars, barbed wire, tear gas.
But activist Dr. Nada Daif says the race brings much-needed media coverage to Bahrain.
If it goes on, then let's use it, then let's expose what's going on, the situation, the violation that's continuing in Bahrain. And if it gets cancelled, then still the propaganda that comes with it is also, it's both ways it can be useful.
Formula One's president, Bernie Ecclestone, has offered to meet Bahrain's anti-government protesters. But he insists the race will go ahead. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
As Egyptians face a crumbling economy, a rise in crime and decline in basic services, many count on one sector of society to keep the nation from the potential of failed statehood. VOA's Elizabeth Arrett has more on the role of Egypt's military during the transition.
Every day, Egyptians seem to face a new crisis: gas shortages, power outages, rising prices. Publisher and political analyst Hisham Kassam blames the deterioration on the Islamist-led government.
I won't be surprised if we wake up soon and there is no power or bread in Cairo. And then there will be a disaster. If things get to that point, the military will have to intervene and push them out of power.
It's a scenario some Egyptians might not mind. The military has long been seen as a force for stability. During the revolution, protesters cheered when the armed forces took charge, chanting, "The people and the army are one." The image has been tarnished since then. Many people feel the generals overstayed their welcome as interim leaders, and leaks from a recent government report implicate them in violence during the uprising. Activist and filmmaker Hala Galal says the army is likely to stay out of politics.
I don't think the army might come back because I believe they left with a contract between them and the Muslim Brotherhood.
Deal or not, it's a delicate balance. President Mohamed Morsi sidelined top generals shortly after taking office, but he came to the military's defense about documents leaked from his office. Ziad Akhil of the Al Ahram Center for Political and Strategic Studies believes the army and the Islamist leaders have drawn clear lines.
I'm sure that was in the agreement between the Brotherhood and the army before, that you don't mess with regional order, you don't mess with fundamental interests, and you don't mess with strategic allies. And that's exactly what the Brotherhood has been delivering so far.
Whether that extends to internal collapse is anyone's guess. Although the possibility that the military could intervene is a source of comfort for some, political analyst Akhil sees that safety net in a different light.
Every Egyptian has this vision that in the end it is the army that saves the day. Yani, there's always a very sick attachment to authority that the Egyptian people have. And the absolute lack of authority is something that is very socially uncomfortable for Egyptians.
Filmmaker Galal disagrees.
This country lived like 1 year and a half without a parliament and without a president and without anything. And the people, they create this organization, what we call officially the civil society, exists, but not in a proper way. It exists. The people, they really, when everything collapses, they support each other.
Whether some pin their hopes on fledgling civic institutions and others on the long-established military, the fear of collapse is one thing many Egyptians seem to share. Elizabeth Tharrett, VOA News, Cairo.
Congratulations to the winner of the VOA Photo Contest. During the month of February, we invited listeners around the world to submit photos depicting the spirit of the communities in which they live. There are more than 4,500 entries from 110 countries. But the top prize goes to Rahan Parvez from Dhaka for his black and white portrait of an older woman protecting her grain from three hungry ducklings. To see the winner and runners-up, visit our website at voanews.com. A major earthquake Tuesday struck the Iran-Pakistan border region, killing about 35 people. The U.S. Geological Survey said the quake had a magnitude of 7.8, making it one of the strongest in the region in the past 40 years. It said the quake occurred mid-afternoon Iran time near the Iranian cities of Kash and Saravan in Sistan and Baluchistan province. It was felt in parts of India and some Gulf states. This office worker is in the Indian capital, New Delhi.
We were in the office, suddenly noticed a tremor, a quick tremor, and then we looked out of the window and we found that things were shaking. I think there were a lot of noise around. People started going out. We were on calls with the other parts of India, especially Gujarat and other places. So there were people from those places also saying that they were also facing some mild tremors. We just quickly ran out of the office, took the stairs and came down. The tremors were massively felt within the office. We looked out of the window and we saw people from other offices also coming out.
VOA's Sharon Bain has more on the story from Islamabad.
Witnesses in Pakistan's southwestern province of Balochistan said the quake shook buildings, and local Pakistani media bordering Iran reported at least 5 dead in the province. Journalist Mohammad Kazin was sitting in the press center in Quetta, the capital city of Pakistan's Balochistan, when the earthquake hit.
It has jolted many parts of almost all areas of Balochistan. All journalists and photographers who were sitting in this press club, they left press club.
Kazin said he had been in touch with people closer to the border who had told him that houses had been flattened by the quake. The strong earthquake was also felt in some areas in Dubai, Abu Dhabi, and the Emirates, and in Doha, Qatar. British national Rachel Wright felt the tremor in Pakistan's southern city of Karachi.
We were in a room and I was talking to somebody and he suddenly said, "What's that?" And then I realized his chair was shaking. And then everybody started leaving the building. We all went outside. The cars were all shaking. Must have lasted, I think about a minute until the cars stopped shaking.
Iran is prone to frequent earthquakes as it sits on several fault lines. On April 9th this year, a magnitude 6 quake shook southwestern Iran near the city of Bushehr, killing at least 37 people. Sharon Bain, VOA News, Islamabad.
This has been VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Join us Monday through Friday for news from the region and of interest to the region. And for more Mideast coverage, visit our website at MiddleEastVoices.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Thanks for joining us.